like when it, when it's late, and it's because of a quick study group consultation with the ANC component of the this committee. But let me take this opportunity to welcome all of you in our meeting today, Commissioner Nancy Wilson and the team. Visitors, guests in our meeting. All of you are welcome to our meeting. I'm having three apologies. One is from Bishop Dolo. Bishop Dolo will join us later because problems of the flight. The weather is not fine since last night. So Bishop Dolo had to sleep in Pulopani last night. Then Mr. Self have apologized on Friday to say he won't make it for today. Then Nkosi Dolo has also sent an apology, apparently rather passed away. That's why he's not here. Other members will join us when we are busy with our meeting. Our agenda for today, I hope that all the members are in possession of the briefing documents. Today the department will brief us on outsourcing and the issue of consultants. There's outstanding matters relating to suspension and claims against the department. But I am going to ask the department, let us deal with outsourcing and consultants. Because the documents are there of the other matter of suspension and claims, but that is not what is on our agenda for today. If there is time, we will deal with it. But you have submitted the documents. I think that this matter of outsourcing and the consultants is a very concerning and very urgent thing that we must address. We have postponed and postponed this debate since last year that we must deal with this issue. So today we want the commissioner to take us through this issue of outsourcing and consultants. After that, we are going to interrogate this thing thoroughly. We want to come up with solutions as this committee. We are not here, Commissioner, to put you in a box, but it's our responsibility as members of the Portfolio Committee and members of Parliament to do our oversight work. And it's very concerning, this matter of consultants and of outsourcing. It's a serious concern to us. I hope that you are going to deal with it and brief us about this issue. Without waste of time, let me hand over to you, Commissioner, so that we have the briefing from you. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee, and good morning also to members of the media. Please allow me to introduce my delegation. In particular, because we have colleagues who are here to report on some of the outstanding issues, but on the main topic, on the agenda that of consulting and consultants, I have the Chief Financial Officer, Ms. Nabila Singh, here with me, sitting on my left. And the presenter, the main presenter, is our Deputy Commissioner responsible for supply chain management, dealing with issues of procurement broadly and other matters related to supply chain management, Mr. Ngubo. Sitting there next to Ms. Shabalala, who, as you know, is the director in the Office of the Commissioner. I also have the Chief Deputy Commissioner responsible for corporate services, Mr. Tetsani, behind me, and the acting Chief Deputy Commissioner, Ms. Mahoro, who is here for the outstanding presentations on the claims against the department and the suspensions, respectively. I also have Mr. Garko, who is the standing in for the parliamentary liaison officer, who has been hospitalized. He's normally the communications person in the office of the deputy minister. Chairperson, then just perhaps by means of introduction to say that indeed supply chain management in the department such as correctional services is a very wide area. And over recent years, especially arising from obligations emanating from the new Correctional Services Act, we have seen a number of new contracts being sourced. And in addition to that, challenges arising from the need to enhance rehabilitation outcomes and security. Also have seen that I'll respond to those challenges by procuring services aimed at enhancing security on the one hand, as well as nutrition services and other technological assistant devices to enhance rehabilitation. So yes, indeed, a major part of our work revolves around contracting. I don't want to say too much. Most of it will be covered in the presentation, and I would rather want to reserve most of my time to perhaps respond directly to questions. But I think it will be important at this stage to perhaps acknowledge two things. That is, within the outsourcing arena, there's always potential for corrupt activity, so I need to be quite upfront. A major concern that we've had within DCS, we have built very strong partnerships with the SIU, the Special Investigation Unit, in order to really combat this on a sustained basis, as well as our own departmental investigation unit that's geared essentially to combat and prevent fraud and corruption, as well as fighting maladministration. And our own DIU itself has been capacitated by the SIU. So there's a very close working relationship. And therefore, to say up front, also from this partnership with them, we've made some significant gains over the recent period. If you would allow me, and this, of course, would also kind of enable us to reflect on some of the challenges arising from outsourcing. But let me first reflect on some of the gains. Firstly, in the 2006-2007 financial year, the year under discussion, I think we should note that through the work of the Special Investigations Unit, we have already recovered 8.8 million rand recoveries. We've saved, the work of the SIU saved us a further amount of 5.8 million rand, resulting in a rescue of 17 people and 557 people disciplined. I need to immediately say that this work is also a culmination of work that occurred over a period of time, mainly arising from the medical aid fraud and the large number essentially relating to people who have been found guilty of defrauding the medical aid a number of years ago. The actual savings on medical aid fraud has been reported previously by the FIU, leading to an overall recovery of 22.7 million rand and the prevention, according to their estimate, of a possible 3.4 billion worth of losses. So sometimes we need to emphasize the fact that procurement fraud will not be tolerated, and those who are found to have been defrauded the state will be tracked down and suffer the consequences, including asset forfeitures. In the current financial year, which is not under discussion so far, I'm happy to report by the end of December we've already registered 12.9 million recovery and 8.3 million savings, with criminal referrals totaling 80, including a further 56 arising from the medical aid fraud and 80 arising from an investigation conducted by FIU under our instruction into pharmacies. So we've just renewed our contract with FIU, and we paid them to do this work. We've just renewed our contract, and you would have seen the proclamation published in November where this work was gazetted, continuing to cover the areas of national and regional procurement, this time also asking them to look into procurement processes around our maintenance project, commonly referred to as RAMP, also to undertake further work in asset management, specifically our farming activities. To continue with work around medical aid fraud and also further work around the correctional centre pharmacies. I'm starting at this point because I think apart from the fact that there are other challenges around procurement, this remains the critical challenge. In fact, Chairperson, we need to acknowledge up front a commitment that I've made to certainly strengthen our capacity to deal with corruption and maladministration in this area in particular. And with the appointment of the Chief Financial Officer and my own appointment, I've given an instruction that we develop the National Fraud Prevention Plan, and emanating from that, to establish the Fraud Prevention Committee to give this work further impetus. I'm happy to say work around that is progressing quite well. We've also looked at lessons that we have learned from the work undertaken by FIU and our own DIU. And so with future procurement, particularly the larger ones, we are focusing strongly on enhancing the integrity in relation to those processes by involving forensic investigators throughout the process, especially at the beginning of procurement processes. Also, we want to intensify, we've already agreed with SIU to intensify the integrity vetting of persons involved in our procurement processes. And to also at this stage, Chairperson, up front, say to this committee that in looking at the patterns that continue to concern us as we go into the presentation, we continue to see the following trends within correctional facilities that concern us and that need to be confronted head on. Firstly, the trend of splitting of orders in order to circumvent the thresholds that's placed on specific procurement processes. We are also concerned about a number of DCS officials contracting directly with the department in contravention of Section 118 of our own Correctional Services Act and Section 30 of the Public Service Act, which prohibits public servants from working outside the public service without authorization. And generally, the continuing non-adherence of our procurement policy, as I've referred to, mainly arising from the splitting of contracts and not allowing for rotation and obtaining the necessary number of quotes. We've also on the national scene, in terms of national contracts, seen a tendency to have BEE fronting, certainly after having reviewed about 5% of our service provider contracts, there is that concern that we ask SIU to continue to focus on. I've already referred to the work around the RAM project and other national contracts. You will, from your visits, be well aware that we have very poor service delivery by certain contractors that we have engaged with, and very poor monitoring by project managers. And then the lack of screening of tenders in terms of the procurement policy. Chairperson, I think making those things explicit up front will enable this committee to better engage with the department. These things are matters which are not included in our presentation. Our presentation, you would notice, contain mainly an overview of our processes as well as the type of contracts that we outsource. But I think we need to up front problematize the issue for better discussion. I'm saying fraud and corruption is one area. Of course, the other area is making sure that we continue to get value for money. How we do that is not the best way to conduct business when you have monopolies functioning within your environment, so we have to create opportunities for further competition to ensure that we do get value for money. We, of course, notwithstanding the challenges that we face, because we need to also take note of the concept of economies of scale when conducting business, we can also remain true to that principle. So, Chairperson, in brief, just by means of introduction, and with your permission then to give the to ask Mr. Ngubu to take us through the overview that we have handed out to the committee members. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Commissioner. I think that this will lay the basis for our discussion. You have raised a lot of very concerning issues here. You have raised it. And I'm sure that we are going to interact with it after Mr. Ngo has presented to us. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Commissioner. The scope of the presentation is going to cover seven headings, starting with what is outsourcing, why do we outsource, what legislative framework informs outsourcing, which services are outsourced, what are the benefits of outsourcing, improvement of procurement system, what are the areas to improve. What is outsourcing? Outsourcing refers to the practice of turning over internal departmental functions, services to an outside supplier. Why do we outsource? We outsource because we need expertise skills that are not available within the department. The high turnover and inability to retain and match what the private sector is offering in terms of salary. Prolonged process of staffing to allow the department to refocus on its core function, improve service delivery of the department on the core services. Enhance a better compliance to statutory requirements linked to core services of the department, for example, Correctional Services Act, Act 21 of 1998, give effect to the other statutory requirements such as Public Finance Management Act, Procurement Policy Framework Act, Health and Safety Act, cost benefits for the department, enhance effectiveness, efficiency, and economy. Methods of outsourcing in public service. We have the public-private partnership informed by the Public Finance Management Act, and Treasury Regulations in Chapter 16, and conventional procurement through the use of Treasury Regulations. Both these methods involve the application of the following acts: South African Constitution, which is Act 108 of 1996, Public Finance Management Act, and legislative framework continues. Broad-based black economic empowerment, that is Act 53 of 2003. Preferential procurement policy framework, Act 5 of 2000. Correctional Services Act, White Paper on Correction, and Departmental Policies and Procedures. The two outsourced services. Two prisons are outsourced by this method. That is Mangaung and Gutamas in Tumule. Those are two correctional centers. What has been outsourced regarding these two centers? It's the design of the centers, the building of the centers, financing of the centers, operating of the centers for a maximum period of 25 years. Other services outsourced through procurement process are as follows. Transaction advisor services for the public-private partnership for a period of 24 months for 11.4 million rand. Appointment of a consultant to assist DCS with compliance and IT audit for a period of 36 months for 7.8 million. Training of personnel in hygiene-related matters for 24 months, 1.8 million. Supply, delivery, installation, and commissioning of security outer perimeter fences and CCTV surveillance cameras for 60 months for 436 million. Maintenance of the above services for 48 months amounting to 50.7 million. Rendering of full facilities management services, which include catering services for 60 months, 123.2 million. Rendering of cleaning services at head office for 24 months, for 2.4 million. Supply, delivery, installation, commissioning of television system and monitoring at all correctional centers for 60 months, amounting to 159 million. Maintenance of the above after warranty of 12 months, for 48 months, it's 65.3 million. Emanating from the recommendation of Public Service Commission and Jali Commission, credible systems for human resource provisioning, that is recruitment and selection and appointment, needed to be formulated, which resulted in the use of external service providers, named below, that is service providers. Mahedra, can you go? I've already read this one. The next one. Yes. These are the service providers. 2.1 for 4.7 million. ITP, 7.5 million. Gray Consulting, 2.7 million. Lumka, for 26,583,000, Leadway for 33,495, JobVest for 36,079, Human Resource Communication for 233,000, totaling to 15.3 million. Benefits of outsourcing. Capacity building during the running of the contract, focus more on the core business of the department, risk transfer, enhancement of the quality of service delivery, value for money, penalty clause can be effected on non-performance and poor service. A significant reduction on corruption-related allegations in the department, recruitment processes. The use of service providers has significantly contributed to the department's establishment of goals indicated in this graph. This graph is showing the finance post in light blue and I would say brown, light brown, its field position, and the white is vacant. For the period 2005 from April, we had filled finance vacancies of 36,118 against filled of 33,712 with a vacancy of 2,406. In 2006, we had 33,999 and filled positions, 36,406. And in 2007, we had the finance position of 45,756 and filled position 40,797. And although there is proportional growth there, but if you look at the amount of people that were employed during that period, it's about 10,000, and which means that there was improvement, significant improvement in terms of the turnaround time within the 2-year period. The next slide. Improvement in procurement system. Effective from March 2004, supply chain management was implemented within the department. Structures were put in place to ensure that procurement is operated in the manner in which is fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost effective, in compliance with the Constitution, Section 217, and Public Finance Management Act, and the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act. Improvement in procurement system. Structures are as follows. National Bid Adjudication Committee, stationed at head office, handles bids exceeding 5 million to infinity. Members are as follows. All executive managers at head office. The chairpersonship rotates among the CDCs. Structures continue. Sub-bid adjudication committee stationed at head office and 6 regional offices handles bids exceeding 200 to a limit of 5 million. Head office managed by the senior management at supply chain management at regional offices, regional head finance and supply chain management officials are in charge of that process. All members of national or sub-bid adjudication committee appointed in writing by the accounting officer. All bid adjudication members have signed the code of conduct. The duties of the adjudication committee, they give final award based on recommendations of the bid evaluation committee. All necessary bid documents are submitted and ensure that qualification of service providers are justifiable and that valid and accountable reasons are furnished for passing over of bids. That is the responsibility of the bid adjudication. Duties and continue ensure that scoring is fair, consistent, and correctly calculated. Ensure that bidders' declaration of interest has been taken into consideration. Ensure that members themselves declare their interest in writing before commencing with the adjudication of bids. These committees can extend the period of the existing contract and can also extend the scope of work according to the delegated powers. Bid evaluation committees evaluate and recommend bids proposals to relevant bid adjudication committee. Members are appointed in writing by the accounting officer. Members differ from cases to cases based on the nature of the bid and the competency of the members in line with the bid to be evaluated. This is an ad hoc committee. Members must declare their interest in writing and sign code of conduct prior to the commencement of evaluation. Where can we improve? We need to conduct stakeholder analysis. Comprehensive feasibility study must be conducted before outsourcing any services. Promote the advantages of a proper procurement plan linked to strategic plan, operational plan, medium-term expenditure framework and budget, maintain the gains and achievements that have already been made, improve contract management, especially by the end users, retain and deploy skills accordingly, build capacity of project officers on project management. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ngubo. Let me welcome, take this opportunity to welcome one of our members here, Jamshi, but he's back, Baba Fika. Baba Fika, you are welcome into the meeting. He is now a whip of the Defense Committee, but his heart is here, it's a blow by gig, so he will never stay away from correctional services. Thank you very much, Mr. Ngubo. Commissioner, I don't know if you have anything to add before we are going into. Is it fine? You know, I'm going to give members a chance to. It's a well-known fact. Your last point on slide 5, page 13. Members must declare their interest in writing and sign code of conduct prior to commencement of evaluation. It's a well-known fact, the two private prisons that we are having, members of the correctional services, who is running, who was there in correctional services, busy with it, with the contracts. Now, has it changed? Is it a new code of conduct or what? The one in Limpopo, the one in, they were part and parcel of the whole process when this thing came up. They were there in the head office, busy, and now they are part and parcel. They are running the two prisons, and not only run, but they are also directors of these. It came up, Commissioner knows, it came up as a question from another committee there, that what guarantee do we have that this thing is not going to happen again, that members who is sitting there dealing with this very big contract are now part and parcel of the very same thing that they themselves have approved. That is one of my questions. But I'm going to give members time to ask questions. I see Mr. Shah, Mayor Winnie Ngwenya, Ms. Sybil Sitton, Mr. Kipido, and then we'll go.
I'm in the
place.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can the department assure this committee and categorically declare state that it is satisfied that in terms of outsourcing, the relevant PFMA and Treasury regulations are being met and have been adhered to, and that all outsourcing projects satisfy the legislative framework, namely two, such as the BBEE, like broad-based black economic empowerment, and the preferential recruitment policy framework, PPP. So we'd like them to tell us in no uncertain terms that is being adhered to. Secondly, we see in this report that the DCS has provided us with a list of outsourced services in terms of meeting the human resource needs, etc., like training, selection, recruitment, etc., and appointments. And they've given us a list. And what about the other major outsourced projects, which are worth millions of francs? Can we have a list of those companies that are providing those services projects, like the private prison project, and the monitoring systems that have put the CCTV and the maintenance system? Who are the people that have got those contracts? Then on page 5, they tell us about private centers, the two private centers. The last bullet states that operating of the centers is for a maximum period of 25 years. Obviously, they've been designed and built and financed and all privately. Now, what happens to these prisons and its management after 25 years. I may be ignorant because I don't attend the committee, this committee regularly, because I'm on defense primarily. So is it that they have provided that information? If they have, then they need not necessarily attend to that one. And finally, with your permission, Chair, I see that in some instances, consultants have been outsourced to great amounts of money. Now, have they ever contemplated the possibility of employing somebody full-time, an expert, and paying him well, and have they measured that against what it's costing them when they do it outsourcing? I mean, if you employ somebody who's a professional and expert, for example, in financial management, let's say, instead of outsourcing, if you weigh that against what it costs you outsourcing and what it would cost you if you employed somebody full-time, an expert, can they perhaps shed some light on that? Have they even did such an evaluation before even outsourcing? I'll stop there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, mine will be on page 5, on bullet 7, on a 25-year period. Chairperson, I'm worried about this 25-year period because our term as members of parliament is 5 years. That when these 25 years we're going to bring our government in problem, because maybe Chairperson, these 25 years will be finished after I'm out in parliament. Maybe that time I will never be a member, I will not be a member of parliament. I want to understand about this 25 years period, Chairperson, and link this 25 years period with a page 13, Chairperson, to add on what you said about the members. Chairperson, on this issue of members must declare, I want to understand, Chairperson, that those members that were having the contract of building the prison, does this members need to declare? Because what we found, Chairperson, is that after these members have the contract of these 25 years, they've been resigned from correctional services and go to the private. Chairperson, I'm very, very worried about this. I need a clarity. Last Chairperson, in terms of the legislation and outsourcing services, what other model available to promote service delivery other than outsourcing? I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Madam Ingwena.
Chairperson, I am covered to a large extent, but there's perhaps still a few questions, and perhaps also just a comment. The 25 years, it's good to know that somebody's got terms of office longer than 5 years, but it is a term of office that we had agreed to in the beginning when we first agreed to a private partnership agreement, so unfortunately not much you can do about that. Just to ask two further questions. With regard to the outsourced services on page 7, and specifically the comprehensive access control and body scanning system, does this include the Westall prison? And are we assured that this is now functional, up and running? Because we have a serious concern, as you well know, with regard to the system that was put in place just a little while ago. Secondly, on page 10, the graph there that shows the impact of the use of external service providers. It's all very good and well, we've now got a lot of extra additional finance positions, but the vacancy rate on the number of positions that we have is actually greater. In 2005, we only had a vacancy of 6.6%. It's now over nearly 11%. And that does concern me. You know, it's all very well having a lot of additional finance positions, but we have so many more vacancies in those positions, and that does concern me greatly.
Thank you, Mr.
Speaker.
Mr. Tupido?
I've also been, to an extent, very much covered by other members' questions, but let me then just comment on the outsourcing now and the experience that so many ex-members, maybe of the service, are involved in this. It is the experience that almost right through consultants have taken over, you know, in the early stages of our new democracy. They've taken over a lot. Those are the people who left the service, the public service. And they knew that there was a shortcoming. And they then became or registered consultancies. And this is how they got involved and still continued enriching themselves, let me put it that way. I would just like to know on the benefits of outsourcing, the focus that is more on the business of the department. I would believe that the business of our Department of Correctional Services is to rehabilitate and put a better person outside. Now, I would like to know, are we succeeding with that? Because there are so many inmates that are returning. We've learned the other day that some of their files are being kept at the centers because there's almost a surety that they will be coming back. So if we are outsourcing some of our responsibilities, and in order to loosen the hands of our rehabilitators, to what extent are we really succeeding? Okay.
Second round after the commission and his team responded. A commissioner responding to this, you have mentioned that, and it's, I know that the president has signed a new proclamation in November last year. Can you explain to us, tell us what is the special investigating unit investigating now? Which contract are the special investigating unit investigating? Because the president can't sign a proclamation if it is not serious. We want to know, as this portfolio committee, what is the contract? Which contract is it that the president has said to the special investigating unit continue to investigate?
Thank you, Honorable Chair, members of the questions. I'm sure the colleagues will assist where I'm not covering some of the questions. Firstly, the question asked by the chairperson regarding the two existing PPPs and the involvement of former members of these. Perhaps just to say, when those contracts were negotiated, one of the things that surely I think negotiators overlooked was exactly that issue of restraint of trade. You will know that it's a big issue that the Public Service Commission has been looking at, also in fact affecting politicians and ministers and public service. Not an easy matter. But we believe that in order for us to ensure integrity of some of these processes, we need the assurance that people will have the correct integrity and kind of a hands-off approach so that they do not compromise the state in the negotiation process because of either interest in a particular company or the possibility that they may want to go and work for the company. So this is what I've said. It's a lesson that we want to extract. And certainly we are looking at, in the first instance, compelling members of negotiating teams, members of bid evaluation teams and adjudication committees to sign such restraint of trade agreements in the first instance. In the second instance, to put the obligation also on the company that the successful tender, that upon you receiving the contract, that we expect you not to, within a particular period of time, employ any of our staff. Clearly, I think, Chairperson, I don't know of any information of former employees actually being active shareholders in any of these companies, other than other examples where I've used the members are not declaring their own interests. These are we find in the small tenders, particularly below 30,000 rand that's being administered at center level. So
can I make an example?
Sure.
One very senior person who wants a director, CEO, he was
a commission at that time when the contracts, the deals were. And then, you know, I don't want to mention a name now, but he was there as a CEO of this company.
Yes, now I'm aware of that case. That's what I'm saying. It's basically an employer-employee relationship as the CEO and not as a shareholder, if we can draw that distinction. And whilst, and the point that I'm making is whilst those negotiations were continuing, we did not have restraint of trade agreements with our own employees. So he was subsequently, as in the case with many others, who these deputies recruited, employed by the private company. But I'm making the distinction as a shareholder versus an employee, and he would fall under the category as an employee, albeit in a senior management position. I'm saying it's certainly something that we are vigorously pursuing, as I've indicated. But also, upfront, also in terms of our other safeguards to make sure that integrity vetting, as I've said, is done at the beginning, during, and different stages of procurement processes. So we can also proactively identify if people have specific interests. The question raised by Mr. Shah, where the department can categorically declare that in terms of outsourcing we are abiding by legislation, Mr. Shah, I wish I can do that. If I did, I would not need the SIU or the DIU for that matter. I would also like to say that perhaps if I restricted procurement to the CFO, I would have been more assured because I would be able to control that a lot better. So I would not be responsible in making that statement. Quite clearly, I'm saying that we are building in the necessary safeguards and the processes and with this committee having also placed much emphasis on compliance and the management of consequences of non-compliance. And together with what I've earlier stated, our resolve to actively pursue people who either have not complied or people who have enriched themselves from our procurement processes. And for that reason, I'm saying I'm quite pleased with the successes that we've achieved through the work of our own departmental investigation unit and our partnership with the FIU in this regard. The other question with regard to the outsourcing services, training and recruitment, what about the list of other projects? I think within the presentation we've covered some of the bigger projects. Of course, you may be requesting for a database. If that's the case, one can find a way of making that possible. Alternatively, some of the key projects, but I think we've listed the key bigger contracts as part of the presentation. If there's a further need, Chairperson, I'm sure we can respond to that for specifics. Your question about what happens to PPPs after the 25-year period, this indeed is one of the risks that we've said we wanted to transfer to the private partners for the full 25-year period, that of maintaining the facility, so that by the end of the 25-year period you have a facility that's actually quite new, well maintained. And on the basis of that well maintained facility, which is built into the contract, it's then handed over to the state, so the property reverts to the state after that period for us to do whatever with, either to then operate it as a more conventional procurement or conventional facility, or to decide otherwise, depending on the information at hand at the time, how we want to deal with it. You've also asked the question whether we have contemplated employing other experts for some of the projects that we've outsourced. I would want to say that part of the process of determining whether or not to outsource indeed requires that you undertake that analysis, the cost-benefit analysis. You will find certain projects, for example, that requires intense work and people with a multiplicity of skills that you will not need throughout. You know, so that if you employ them permanently, they will be wasted for many years to come. Really, that's part of the dilemma that we have, that we tend to outsource largely in areas where there are specialized skills that are very expensive and where you find where you have difficulty in attracting them to work for the state. But also, if you consider some volumes that need to be dealt with, the outsourcing model becomes a lot more attractive. I think one exception to that rule is possibly the recruitment project itself, where you would know that recruitment is a fairly routine process and it doesn't require that many experts. But I think just to remind the committee that the recommendation to look at outsourcing part of our recruitment processes comes very strongly out of the Jali Commission recommendations in order to bring further integrity to our recruitment processes. And so we've tried to balance our own recruitment with that of also using outsourced contractors. The second reason why, in that case, we've used outsourced contractors is mainly because of the volumes. You would recall also that our decision to move towards a seven-day establishment required us to populate our establishment quite rapidly with a large number of entry-level staff. So to deal with those millions of applications for which you require warehouses to store applications, it really made it easier for us to do so within the time frame available to us. Ms. Ngwenya's question about the 25-year period, I think I agree with you, Ms. Ngwenya. 25 years is a long time, and I think let's hope. We can always revisit the issue of 5 years. Clearly, that's not up to me. I'm sure it's up to your party and the election. But for that matter, the 25 years, we've had this discussion the last time we were here, partially, really in terms of the period of time and the cost implications and viability. I'm not going to give too much detail here and cover the same ground that we've covered last week. You've also asked the question related to members who must declare whether they in fact declared. Just to explain again that these people only became involved with the PPP after they've left the employ of DTS and not during the process of negotiations or adjudication. You've then further asked us to clarify about other models other than outsourcing models. I'm sure my CFO can give a bit more information on that. Indeed, we do use other models, whether it's co-sourcing with others, and of course the traditional procurement method, or the traditional method of us doing the service ourselves. But it's also linked to, I think, a subsequent question, and I'll come back to that when I deal with the response to Mr. Kibidu's concern. Ms. Seaton, the issue of comprehensive access control and body scanning, whether that included Westfall, I think you're probably referring to the problems that we've had with regard to the inmate tracking system at Westfall. On the 4th of March, we will have a comprehensive presentation on the inmate tracking system itself, so I'm not going to cover that there, but certainly the scanning and access control, indeed, as one of the bigger facilities within Westfall. You've correctly also highlighted the problem with the vacancy rate, growing with the number of staff growing. The response to that, something that we have continuously debated as a committee, firstly, when you deal with such large numbers, it becomes a bit more difficult, especially when you consider the specialized nature. That very often to find people with security expertise, for example, outside of DTS is extremely difficult. So what tends to happen is for people inside to be employed and then creating a new vacancy. So you're really just going through the paces. And the only way that you can then increase the numbers is by increasing your intake level in order to reduce the vacancy rate. And of course, we've also debated that the fact that our existing capacity at the college caters for 1,035 people on the maximum. We've tried to find innovative ways of increasing that by employing people to start off at centers and then sending them to college, having completed a few of the modules first and so on. So we think with our continued focus on recruitment at an entry level, we will make a big dent into this vacancy rate, particularly as we are about to appoint another intake as of the 1st of April this year. So that should impact on the vacancy rate quite considerably. Of course, the bigger the vacancies that we experience are really in the area of skills, and there it's extremely difficult for us to make the necessary impact. Pharmacists, medical doctors, psychologists, and so on, the traditional areas where we struggle, we are quite hopeful that with the introduction of the occupation-specific dispensation for nurses, for psychologists and social workers and others, that we will be able to reduce the vacancy rate in that area and to retain the number of staff that we've recruited. So there is work, in addition to some of the other strategies that we are embarking on, both headhunting, counter-offers, and frameworks that we've put in place to enable staff to recruit much faster. But mainly, given the fact that we have, on the one hand, implemented the white paper, on the other hand, moved towards the phasing in of the seven-day establishment, we have and our resolve also to strengthen compliance by employing junior and middle managers and supervisors. These are the reasons for the increase, the rapid increase in the numbers that impacts on our vacancy rate. So we're quite happy with the growth, but of course we have to do much more to reduce that actual rate. Mr. Kibidu's question relates to the ex-members. Again, I think I've responded to part of that question. You have made a very interesting comment, Mr. Kibidu, that many civil servants left the state and created an artificial scarcity and are now selling those services back to the state. Something that we are quite vigilant about when it comes to former public servants. In fact, I think we need to draw a distinction between outsourcing per se and the use of consultant services, because I think there's a blurring there. If you look at the last annual report, for example, you can see that the use of consultants, where the risk of former civil servants coming in, that number is quite low. In fact, the two, we refer to two projects where we've used consultants, and mainly relating to the development of our junior and middle management training with a consortium consisting of the Tshwane University of Technology, amongst others. And the other the other use of consultant really refers to the use of the transaction advisors, highly specialized. So I think we've radically reduced, or we're really not using the kind of individual consultants. And normally public servants would either have to find their way through some of the other major contractors and come in that manner. So yes, we are quite vigilant of that trend and try to combat it actively. You then also make a very useful and interesting observation about the core function of BCS being rehabilitation. I think that it remains a challenge for us to constantly ask that question, what is core and what should we occupy ourselves with, given the fact that many of these things require highly specialized people that you begin to use inappropriately. For example, I mean, we still have to ask the question whether us administering our transport fleet is core to our business. Why should we use a qualified correction official to do that? Of course, the decision on outsourcing of the way it offers value for money, and often it does, where it offers value for money, a better service, we will have to continuously make that assessment. You are saying, of course, if we say that we need to focus on what is core in order to ensure that we provide space for our staff to focus on rehabilitation, what then is the level of success of our rehabilitation efforts? And that is a very important question. I think the subject that we can have for a much longer debate, except at this point to say that that's indeed our entire focus of the white paper, and we know that the transformation process to achieve those outcomes will take a bit longer. We are making some successes. There are really many impediments that we have to address. Most of all, the impact of overcrowding, for example, on our correctional facilities that mitigate against that. The fact that we need to make more greater possibilities for people to serve sentences and to ensure that non-custodial sentences are indeed viewed as effective punishment, because you will realize that the possibility of rehabilitation is greater if a person doesn't enter our facility in the first place. So the use of non-custodial sentencing options in itself will enhance our rehabilitation outcomes. Those coming from our facilities, we know people very easily talk about people having been rehabilitated, but we know that there are many factors that influence a person upon his or her release. And most of all, you would recall that no matter how successful we've been, that person is still released in a situation of unemployment, for example. That person is still released in a situation where there's no support network, family support network in particular. And therefore, we need to make sure that our social integration work and our partnerships with others that assist released inmates, that is really strengthened. Recently, we've had a stakeholder conference where we had a presentation from Business Against Crime, and they had a very interesting statistic. I think in South Africa, we don't have reliable statistics that measure the what we call the recidivism rate, the reoffending rate. But Business Against Crime, from some research, which I don't know where they got it, estimated the recidivism rate at this stage to be around 94%. That's extremely high. The last time I recall when research was conducted at a youth facility, because you can only do this over a longer period, through longitudinal studies, the last time such a study was conducted in South Africa, it came up with a rate of 90%. In other words, only a 10% success rate. So it supports the point that I'm saying that incarceration is not necessarily very good. In South Africa, certainly, rehabilitation outcomes have been quite minimal. But in other jurisdictions, particularly in other countries, we've seen recidivism rates of 60% and lower in places such as Japan and some of the other Western countries. Of course, one needs to analyze, Chairperson, why that is the case. I think in Japan, the level of community involvement by having what they call volunteer probation officers, where you deploy lots and lots of people to look after people once they have been released, surely that must be one of the factors that contributes to the successful integration rate. We have been working very closely with the Center for Security Studies to begin to do some work for us to develop a model to measure recidivism in South Africa, and some interesting work around that area that's beginning to emerge. So yes, if we want to say we're focusing on rehabilitation, we need to be able to measure it effectively, apart from seeing our people up to do exactly that, and we are working on making that possible through some of these examples that I've said. And then finally, Mr. Bloom, you've asked me to come back on the issue of the presidential proclamation. I've tried to explain in my introduction that the proclamation really is a general proclamation because, as I've said, we enter into agreements, partnership agreements with the FIU every 3 years. And in 2006, we signed a new agreement. My predecessor signed an agreement with the FIU that extended that 3-year contract for a further 3-year contract. And the process took a bit long because it was only in May this year that the FIU then submitted their proposal for the proclamation to be gazetted to the Department of Justice, and effectively the President then signed that proclamation on the 27th of November 2007. So it really covers general areas around procurement, the ramp, continuation of work around medical and medical aid, as I've explained. There are certain specific investigations that I've asked FIU to zoom in on. Chairperson, it's not in the interest of this committee or myself for me to disclose that, because that will just create problems for the people who are under investigation. So I can assure you that it covers some of the areas that I am concerned about and some of the areas that this committee in the past have expressed concerns about. And I hope that will satisfy you at this point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now you are correct. If a group knows that it's going to be investigated, then it's going to close the loopholes. You are correct. I agree with you on that one, Commission. Mr. Shah, you will get your chance. And other members who also want to ask, you'll get your chance, Mr. Shah. Please don't harass me. You'll get your chance, Mr. Shah. You will be the first that I'm going to give a chance to have a follow-up. But Ms. Chikunga wants to have it. Before that, let me welcome the Minister and Deputy Minister in our meeting. Minister and Deputy Minister, I will give you 2 seats here in front so that you can come and sit here in front. Minister and Deputy Minister.
Yep,
are you okay then?
Okay.
Are you okay? No, that's fine. That's fine. Ms. Chikunga, Mr. Tsele, Ntate Maote, then Mr. Shah.
Thank you, Chief President, and thank you for the presentation. Chief President, in the presentation, what is highlighted in the main are the benefits of outsourcing. And I think we cannot have a model or anything that has benefits only without disadvantages of law. What are the disadvantages of outsourcing? And also, we have our agenda, which is about building a developmental state. How is outsourcing assisting us in building a developmental state? In fact, is it at the state or which action? And also, Chairperson, how do we ensure that the contracted companies do follow the government policy? For instance, we say we are rural poor biased, and I'm relating that in particular to the recruitment, which is outsourced. And I will always say that I've not seen any time from my area being taken, and it's rural, very poor. And also, the private sector is about profit making, and ours is about service provision. With so many services being outsourced in correction, how do we ensure that we continue to maximally provide quality service, not being about profit making? And lastly, Chairperson, you know, on page 9, the recruitment agencies that are there, you know, there is this Lumka, and for me it sounds a woman, and typical of everything in departments, the amount is 26,000, the lowest, as usual. I'm not very sure whether this is an indication of the fact that women companies, like it happens continuously, are given the lowest whatever contracts, just as a way of saying we do empower women, but that empowerment is not quality empowerment. I just want to check on that, because it's 26,000 typical. the rest, comma something million and so on. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much.
I think I'm referring to the correct document when you took off the 21st year. Yeah. You'll correct me if I'm wrong. June 6 minutes. I'm quoting from the 26 minutes of 2006. Mr. Gillingham, no, let me start by Mr. Motegi. There's a part where you say the TFM was flexible enough to provide for any eventuality that could not be satisfied. If the DCF made a down payment, the payment that would follow the lower, it continued on and on. And then Mr. Gillingham was responding to Mawade. Mawade asked whether it would be possible to reduce the length of the 15 years contract. Gillingham responded by saying that the 3-year term was negotiated. Now, I'm raising this because the 21st year is a worry to us. And here, Mr. Gillingham was talking of a 15-year that can be negotiated. I think we need to check that as well. Then, another issue that I wanted to find out, what is in the cover of the issue? You see, I'm not sure whether we're questioning our process. We need to check that as well if I will not be in the Department of Correctional Services if we outsource everything. Because to me, our process is everything. And also, I wanted to check from the Department who trains these officials that are working for the private center. Are they trained by the private center or are they trained by us? And in terms of the salary, who gets more, our or those that are working for the private center?
Thank you, Mr. Fulalet. Mr. Temamot.
No, Chair, I think I'm almost covered. But I want to commend the Commissioner and the Department about what he said in his opening remarks about those corrupt elements and the proactive way that they are using with the FIU and others. The only thing that I'm left with, Chair, I think, is to maybe not in this meeting, because in one of the slides, there are vacant posts, and the Commissioner referred to those vacant posts as guest seats. I think at some point we need to get a breakdown of all of those vacant posts. Lastly, I just want to know from the Department, because before the outsourcing of everything, there were departments, people that were employed by the Department of Correctional Services doing these services. What happened to those people? Have they been redeployed around the Department or what? Because there's a mention of value for money. Now, what happened to those people? Let me make an example. If there was a human resource department with people dealing with recruitment and employment, now it is out of the department or part of it is out of the department. What happened to the people that were doing the job? Have they been redeployed around the department?
Thanks. I will add to what you said.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to, I think, first present an analogy before I phrase this question, and this is in follow-up to the two questions I asked earlier on. Chairperson, we have in this gentleman here an excellent cameraman, right? He was employed for the task. Now, suppose we said we need a consultant for him and for each of the other cameramen that the SABC or whichever, with it, ETV, whoever. That would then suppose, that would raise many questions and fears. Cost is one of them. But then the question that we have to ask is then, why was he employed as a cameraman if we have to have a consultant for him? Now, we can understand that he might need advice and minimal assistance if new equipment is put in his hand, he'll need some further advice as to how to adapt to that new technology. Then we can understand. Now, having understood that by way of analogy, now my question is, I value and recognize the purpose and efficacy of outsourcing. There's no doubt about that. However, certain areas for me is a matter of concern. For example, the appointment of a consultant to assist DCS with compliance. Now, I understand, as the Commissioner Sender said, told us, that this consultant's task, I think the nature of his job would be to train middle management, am I right? Middle management, financial managers, etc. Now the question is, why were those people employed in that position in the first place? If now we need to spend so much for a consultant to teach them how to adhere to compliance matters? And if they were not employed in that position and were promoted to that position, that's even more grievous. Why were they then promoted to that position? That's one of my areas of concern. Secondly, the Commissioner told us that after the 25-year period, the two private prisons that have been that property will revert back to the state. But to my question of what happens to it, he said, well, the state can make some use. I cannot imagine what other use or purpose can the state have for such a building which has been purposefully designed to hold inmates. So is he saying there that the department has outsourced something, but they have no future plans for it after 25 years, because it will go back to the state? What possible use can the state have for it? Should there be not a plan as to perhaps it be put out to tender or something? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
A prison will remain a prison. You can't have a church in that building because it's a prison. So that is what the commissioner has said. If after 25 years, that building and the inmate, maybe you are also there inside, will belong to the correctional service. Everything that is inside the I can make an example of myself. If I am there in Mangaung, then the property, everything, the chairs and the water, everything, will belong to correctional services. I'm trying to make it very easy for you to understand. That's why I'm making an example. I know that you are a law-abiding citizen. You will never find yourself there. I know that, Mr. Shah. But, Commissioner, the issue of recruitment, it's Cindy and Mr. Mawaka, whoever raised it. According to my understanding and information, these recruiting agencies, they are receiving this lot of 1 million and whatever applications. Then this application, they will shortlist and go through it and what, and send it back to the Department of Correctional Services for the Department of Correctional Services to make a decision now who is best. Now, is it not duplication? And I want to say it up front that as a committee we disagree. You must review that issue of recruitment, outsourcing this thing, because we don't. You see, Cindy Chukunga have raised that, and this is now I think the third time that we are raising it. I think the second time that we are raising it. We disagree. We must be convinced that. You see, you are sitting with more than 1,000 people in the head office there. Mr. Mawate is right. There is units in each and every regional office, human resource desk there. The head office, that's a human resource desk. And the CDC is here, Mr. Tessan. It's his area of work. Now, if we are having this lot of people, including Lumka, who's getting 26,000 rand. Why are we doing this? I understand you are saying that the Jali Commission, and it's true, the Jali Commission have raised that. But the Jali Commission also said that we must build capacity. It's not forever. that we must have this. You are having the DIU now, the Special Investigating Unit. If there is corruption in recruitment, then these officials must be arrested. But we can't spend millions of rand recruiting, and we are having people who can do that. I just want to add what Mr. Mahote and Mr. Chukunga is saying. But over to you to respond to this.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members, just to make sure that I'm not charged for wasteful expenditure by bringing my colleagues here. I'm going to ask Mr. Ngubo to take the first question from this round, with your permission, and then the CDT Corporate Services will come in and deal with the other equipment questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. The question was the advantages that we have indicated for outsourcing, but what would be the disadvantages of outsourcing? The first one of outsourcing is that when you have outsourced a service, when the people that have been providing that service leave, they leave you in the same position which you were in before they came, if you are not careful in terms of the specification that you craft around what they need to do and the expertise and knowledge that they need to leave behind. For the people that will be, because they won't be there for the rest of their life. They are there for a short period, and after that, they need to transfer the knowledge and skills to other people. The other disadvantage of outsourcing sometimes is that if it is not properly managed, is the value that has to be generated from the use of those consultants that are there. And also that we are also a national department. If you appoint consultants, you need to consider the six regions that we are responsible for. And most of the consultants that are there, they are not that big to actually cover all regions that are actually there. So you find that in some instances, the services that are rendered in other regions are inferior to other regions where they are actually based, because all the resources are actually concentrated in that area. The other issue that was raised was the issue of the policy, the services that also in the developmental stage, that as we are here, are we enhancing the development, I assume, of the country? What we have done to assist even with small businesses to develop and be at the par with big businesses is that every year, in fact, all regions, they call for stakeholder in to actually take them through our procurement processes, assisting them, and looking at those fine prints that are there, so that at the end of the day, they are able to win these tenders. They also tell us what their concerns are, especially in areas of quotations and in areas of database, how that works. In areas where there is non-performance, which we raise to them as a serious and a big risk to them, because some of them you find that they are actually a person who is a go-between between a big company and himself, and as a result of that, you find that he commits himself in supply of service only to find that he cannot do it. And we find that at the end of the day, we have to blacklist him. We try, in fact, this is a yearly thing that we have, not only at head office, but in all regions, they actually do the same, to actually try and capacitate the small businesses.
If with Honourable Chair, if I can ask the Honourable Minister to just respond to the issue of the colleges and in relation to recruitment. I think he's under pressure also to leave to my greatest appointment, but with your permission. Good morning, Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. What disappointment, Commissioner? You can't be disappointed by the fact that the minister has to leave. Chairperson, thank you very much, and good morning to the members. We do apologize. We had a committee meeting this morning together with the deputy minister. We would want to commit ourselves to coming to portfolio committees whenever we have the opportunity, so that we don't see the portfolio committee only as that for the officials. That one is made very clear that we are as responsible to lead this department as any other minister in government. So sometimes these things clash. So we had to go to that meeting this morning. But we thought we should make a turn around here to support the department, but also to support the portfolio committee in the work that it does on oversight on us. Just two things. I can assure the members that we are committed to a developmental state. And that's probably one day we need to have just a session where we can talk about that commitment. How does it translate into the work that we do as a department? How do we see ourselves assisting in the development of that developmental state? To me, that would be a wonderful discussion to have so that we can look at the regions and see how the regions are doing in contributing to this developmental state. But also break it down, look at the centers. Each center, what is each center actually doing to benefit people around that center, but also to make sure that it's a sustainable development and committing itself to that developmental state that we want. So that's the first thing I want us to be very clear about. I'm not going to cover everything. We've got two colleges, and if one can cast one's mind back, in one of the meetings, I mentioned the fact that these two colleges are not enough. We need more colleges, if people can cast their minds back. To me, it would be so good if we could have colleges in each region, so that we are able to know that we are covering most of the regions in getting mostly, particularly in terms of recruitment, those that are at entry level, because those are the people that we need most. We can talk about scarce skills, but that's a level where everybody competes at a scarce skill level. Those are nurses, doctors, professionals. We compete with other departments and with other countries. But at a recruiter level, which is one of my favorite levels of recruitment, where you get this standard 12, or what do you call it nowadays? It's grade 12. You get them in, and you get them in two ways, which I've said time and again, we must do that, so that we can capture those who live in Barberton must be employed around Barberton. Those who are employed in Ngome must be employed around Ngome, so that we don't have the problem of housing and accommodation. And also the movement of a person recruited in Ngome, going to work in Potchefstroom, and then within 2 or 3 months, that kid is struggling to make ends meet. They want to go home because the rental is too much, everything is too much. So we did in 1 year, if you remember, Mr. Bloom, we did have recruitment in about 5 areas where we said we'll have a two-way recruitment system. Those that come into the center and get training, on-the-job training, and then those that go straight to the colleges, and then they swap around after six weeks? Mm-hmm. About 6 weeks, yes. We did that in Middle Rift, in Ngome, in other areas. But what the problem became, if people can cast again their minds back, was that there was a lot of written things about corruption and unethical behavior, because they were applying to those centers. And you might find that in those centers, there is a Jacobus who works there. And it so happens that two Jacobus kids get employed there without even the Jacobus head knowing about it. But then it is taken up as an issue of corruption. So to cut down on these interventions, let's go the route of outsourcing this thing. And the Jali Commission was very clear in that, that a lot of wrongdoing did happen during that particular phase, but before that. Let's change the way we look at things. But I do agree with yourselves as members to say, now that we've got all the necessary security establishments in place, shouldn't we revert back to having that thing done properly now, knowing that whoever is going to be corrupt is going to be arrested? So to me, that makes sense. But the second part is, you're right to say in human resources we have people. But the numbers, sheer numbers, particularly at the recruiter level, the sheer numbers are huge, very huge, to an extent that it takes days and months to open those applications, as much as you have that human resource under Alf Tsetsane, but it still takes a lot. And it then pushes people at headquarters to do overtime, whereas we are saying to regions, don't do overtime, if you remember. Again, let's go back in our minds. Don't waste our money with overtime. But then at national headquarters, they'll have to do that kind of overtime. So that to create balance, we went for pinpoint. I can assure you that I know about pinpoint because we said, let's go for these companies and see what they give us. It is very true what also Cindy is saying. Sometimes that recruitment is not as, as spot on as we would want it to be. Spot on in terms of Ikopo, Chepstein, and what have you. It just looks at all those things that it needs, then gives the gross list back to the department to do the short listing and everything. But I can assure you, the department can go back to that recruitment. But the last thing I want to emphasize is this thing, that when we recruit for Kimberley, let's try and get Kimberley recruits. When we recruit for a particular area, let's get kids from that particular place. Because you're trying to do two things, that developmental stage you're talking about, but secondly, to give work and ownership to people in that area, to have the feel that this center is not just a center, it's our center. And therefore, what's going to happen here, we will be part and parcel of that particular center. So these two colleges are not enough. We need more colleges, and I've been pushing the commissioner to do that. Let's look for other colleges. The KwaZulu-Natal area is huge. It must have its own college. The Free State and Northern Cape are big areas. Maybe we could have a small college there. Then you have the Eastern Cape and the Western Cape, which are huge areas. That also, you need to have that. Lastly, one of the members asked if these are paid by us. Yes, when they're recruited by us, they are paid by us. But those that are in the two PPP centers are recruited by those people given the job to do. But again, there's something you cannot stop. Can't stop some of our members being recruited by those PPPs. They do. When I got in, some of our staff members had gone over to the people to get employment. And PPPs, again, something that the union needs to look at, does not pay them as the public service says we've got to pay them this way because we are governed by, am I right, sir, by the Public Service Commission or Public Finance Management Act. So you can't just pay them willy-nilly. You've got to pay them according to that. But the PPPs can do it their own way, and therefore, as a result, they are paid better there than they are paid with us. And again, it's something that unions have raised this from band members with unions. When we had a strike one time at Kuntama, and I raised this and said, how do they hope that we will go and rescue them when they are paid so well, and my members are not paid that well, but we've got to go and rescue them now because they're in trouble. So we have those kinds of contradictions, which can be sorted out with the assistance of the members talking to the unions, because they are under one union, all of them. They're under Pop Crew. Even those that are in the PPPs are under Pop Crew. So unions must assist us as a department to make sure that there is a balance in whatever we do. The last thing, Mr. Sharp, once it's given over, any facility or infrastructure that's been given out for PPP, whatever, when it's given back, to the government, to the state. So those two will remain correctional facilities. They can't be anything else. They are just given over for management and everything after 25 years. But they can't be changed into something that's different. Chairperson, thank you. I've taken much of your time. We've got to leave with the deputy minister. But I know one thing. We have tried to cut down on interventions that are illegal in recruitment, on corruption. We have really cut that down. And sometimes corruption is perceived. And I make this example with Mr. Robas. Mr. Robas being the center, the head of center, doesn't know much about the recruitment. There is a level where recruitment is done. But unfortunately, in the process, two Jacobuses. Maybe he's not even related. She's not even related to Jacobuses. But it's a perceived thing, and it causes a problem. But that's the way I'm putting it. But this discussion on the developmental state, we would like to have it, that we can sit and talk about it and bring the official so that they also can be on the same par with us in understanding what we are trying to achieve as a government. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Minister. Commissioner, you can be sure it's not fruitless expenditure. With the Minister, it's not fruitless expenditure. It's value for money. The Minister have responded. Now, Minister, no, it's fine. We will excuse you from the meeting. I don't know if the Commissioner wants to respond to some of the other issues.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and honourable members. Now, the minister has touched on a number of the issues that one wanted to raise. But on the recruiting agencies, we had contracted them for 2 years, up to end of March 2007. So, and that's where the amount of work, where we had a lot of pressure and we had a number of vacancies that we needed to fill. So the contract with the three main ones, I think in terms of the breakdown of the cost, those are the ones, because they've been with us much longer. So that's why the amounts are much higher, because what the approach we followed was to contract a certain set of providers that from time to time, when we need response engine, when we need them to assist us in either advertising and doing all the work, gathering the and capturing, and then would ask for a quotation from only those three rather than going much wider. But after the expiry date of the end of March, we then opened it and now allowed even the smaller ones coming in. But to the honourable member, maybe the name must not mislead us, because I may, as a name, name it after my wife or my mother or my daughter, and then it's not necessarily that it's a woman empowerment one, because amongst the others, there are also women empowerment issues that we had to look at. So the use of these consultants mainly is currently, it's not just for the entry level recruitment. If members would have realized the last recruit advert that we were doing ourselves, and the Kimberley one, we're handling that ourselves internally. But that also comes with what the minister has indicated, some of our people working overtime to be able to cover up the work, or even opening it on contract to bring others who are unemployed from outside to come and work and do the capturing, sorting out of all the applications, because we, at the entry level, we receive close to about 3 million applications at a time. So it's single applications that we have to go through and make sure all that the documents are then captured properly. So you need quite a big pool, and I think that's where they assisted us. But
you are saying that the contract ended in expired in March 2007. Yes. You have not renewed it.
We have not renewed the contract, but what
and you are not going to renew.
No. What I'm saying, Chairperson, understands that you may have certain pressures that you want to accelerate certain recruitment processes. Then you may have to consider on a quotation basis, but not a contract, that you may go out to many others and say, we want to do this work. can you assist us, and then choose the better one out of that. So I think that is how we may have to engage them, rather than having with a fixed number of contractors a signed contract.
But you see, Mr. Commissioner, I'm saying that we did agree with this issue of outsourcing of recruitment. Cindy has made an example. Mawate has made an example. And what are these 1,000 people doing? We hear the argument of 3 million applications. We hear. Okay?
Yes. No, I was not through with my explanation, Chairperson. I was still continuing. The other area where we need to engage external providers is when you're recruiting people in specialist areas where you need to have funds, you need to go out and get. So that's where you'd get a team of recruiters or a company to go and do the search for you and present to you, and then you take a decision from there, which is a normal practice right across government and in the private sector. What happens when we are engaging outsourced or other engaged consultants, depending on the nature of the contract, there should be transference of skills, that afterwards they work to capacitate the team that you have, because you have a large volume. Then having left, these people must have capacitated your own people, your own system, for you to be able to grow afterwards. So it's not that people are deployed or they are dropped out, or it's because we're not utilizing the resources that we have, but it's also to capacitate the resources that you have.
How long have these services been outsourced, and what is the result? I think one of the members have asked that. The thing is to empower our own people. How many of our own people have benefited from this outsourcing of recruitment?
Chairperson, I'm saying it depends on the nature of the contract that you engage. What is it that you are expecting from the contractor to assist you with? So if there is an area where people need a transference of skills, you'll have your own people partnering with them. Where it's just response handling, capturing, and so on, it's something that your own people can do at the risk of employing more people on contract, because you can't employ too many people for a volume that you need to do only for a specific period of time. But if you go to carry that job right through, because if you look at entry-level recruitment, it doesn't happen right through. It happens at certain points. That's where you need a lot of people coming in, and then you take your processes forward. But we are saying, with the current, we are not utilizing the consultant, we are utilizing our own people, but the requests that are on the table from the region is that we are going to either work overtime, our own staff working overtime to deal with the volume, and also employ people on contract to be able to do that work. So, but in areas where we need specialized people in terms of recruitment, we are still going to, through the procurement processes, acquire the services of those the consultants that can assist us. So in the list, those that are seen not to have been, to have had not the benefit to a great extent, is because they started engaging after the contract has closed. So they have not done a lot of work for us, which is an indication that we are scaling down in terms of utilizing the contract, the provider, to a great extent.
Thank you.
Chairperson, perhaps we can pick up on a few other questions. Mr. Kennedy,
yeah,
he was going to suggest a break, but I think it's Mr. Kelly is referring to a presentation in June 2006 that was made, and I have not had the benefit of refreshing my memory, and I've not been here, but I can only imagine what a debate was at the time. As we discussed last week, the department, after the initial terms of reference that we've given to the transaction advisor, to look at the, compare the normal procurement method for these PPPs to compare the traditional procurement method with PPPs, to ask them also to look at what we call the PFM, the public finance model, which is an alternative to a PPP itself. And the public finance model is really a situation where the service provider builds, provide the financing for it, and do the maintenance. And that was part of the terms of reference given to the transaction advisor, certainly for this round, in order to explore PFM as a model, because that was the model that the department favored very strongly, as I reported last week. What we have then said is that when we do have the PFM model, what we can do in addition to that is to put down a very bigger down payment. In other words, then you would reduce the amount of money that the successful tenderer would have to go and lend on the market, and so therefore it becomes a bit more affordable. These are things that the transaction advisor engaged with in doing their feasibility study, and I think the the main result of their assessment was that the market would not be favorable, because it reduced the possibility of profit, and it reduced, furthermore, the issue of value for money. If you look at actual comparisons, and I don't have that information, I think it's something like when you looked at the value for money for a PPP, on average was in the region of 20-odd% savings to the state. In the PFM model, it was between 0.6 to 0.8%. So that's part of the factor that thrown into this model in order to arrive at the decision. I'm giving you that detail knowing that it's not the issue on the agenda, but to specifically then address the issue of a 15-year period, in the modeling that they do in arriving at a decision, the number of years also determines actually the cost to the state. If you reduce the number of years, you end up paying more. For a shorter period, for obvious reasons, it becomes more expensive to lend money and so on. The point that he was saying is that if we had our own preference, we would have preferred a PFM model restricted to a 15-year period. I can only assume that that's what he said. But what we want as a department and what the experts come up with is a different matter. And so it's really around that debate. I hope I've tried to cover that question. Then you've also asked a question related to whether we're not weakening the department by outsourcing everything. I can assure you we're not outsourcing everything. That will really mean weakening the department. Some of us will be without jobs. Indeed, the whole discussion is premised on the fact that there are certain things that the private sector can do a lot better than government and more efficiently in terms of cost. And therefore, we must be able to make that assessment of where we are able to outsource at a better cost, a better value, a better product to be delivered by state compared to government. And those efficiencies we can debate. There are certainly things that government can do a lot better than outsource contractors. I think the minister tried to address the issue of salaries, who gets paid more, and I don't want to contradict the minister, because he kind of suggested that the PPP pay their people more. If one looks at the salaries of these people employed by PPPs, then certainly one may arrive at that conclusion. But if you look at the total cost to employers, then I think you will get a slightly different picture. I'm saying saying if you look at the salaries, then the minister is right. If you look at total cost to the employer, then the minister, unfortunately, must be corrected in that regard. And when we talk about, yes, I'll advise him. The minister may not.
That the minister is right by saying that. That's right and wrong.
Listen to me carefully. I don't want to get into trouble. When it's on a simplistic basis upon based upon what salaries people earn in the ministry is trying to. When you look at the total cost of the employer, then he may not be correctly informed. and when we look at the total cost of the employer, you factor in a range of other things like, you know, your medical aid, for example. You look at the fact that we have overtime that influences the per capita payment to our individual members. You look at issues such as uniform that we provide to our members and official houses. They're not attracted to go. In fact, those people are quite keen to come back to us. You'll be surprised, yes. So I think it's a bit more complex than simply a matter of they are earning more than DCS officials. We are quite competitive at this state. And that's part of, in fact, if I don't correct that, that's part of the reason why PPPs can reduce the cost to a large extent. I think we covered that, for instance, when we spoke about other overheads, like the fact that none of the PPPs provide official accommodation, for example. So you totally eliminate the need for building state housing. And yet they're able to employ the people in those areas, and they don't seem to have any problems. So that considerably influenced the cost on the side of government. I think, Mr. Mawate, I hope you've been covered. and thanks for the acknowledgement of the work. I thought the CFO would come and talk about those things, the improvements that we have introduced to ensure that we improve the integrity. Because, Chairperson, I can tell you I expose my ignorance from time to time. She's the financial guru, and she's very strong on issues of governance. And earlier on, I spoke about the hands-off approach, and I thought I was quoting my CFO. But she's really talking about the importance of ensuring an arm's-length approach. So correcting even that confusion when it comes to negotiations of these major contracts. So I would like that she at some point also talk about issues of governance around our procurement processes in order to give this committee some assurance around what things are that we are doing given our expertise. The analogy of Mr. Shah, I've asked if the SFEC would want to respond to that, and she declined. because I thought he would be a lot more suitable. Because you see, Mr. Shaw, is really about what is your core business. If the SABC's core business is about communication and media, then that would be core. I wouldn't outsource that as the SABC. But if you ask me in DCS whether I should outsource a cameraman who should take videos of some of it, I'll definitely outsource it as DCS. So that's the kind of distinctions that we have to draw. There's no one response. It depends on what's core, what you're about, and whether you can get a service cheaper if that's not what you do on a day-to-day basis. But she declined to give that explanation.
It's like
normally
that.
Like that.
You can only talk on the radio, but when you ask her to answer a question, she declined.
I'd like to turn the table on the media from time to time. I think the other issues may have been sufficiently covered by my colleague and the minister, and I would just ask the CFO to comment on some of the governance issues, if you don't mind, Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you, Commissioner. The Chair and Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee and our colleagues. To give the committee some assurance, particularly with procurement going forward and some of the major contracts looming on the horizon, again, we are definitely exploring methods very aggressively, firstly to encourage competition, because it's always good for us as a consumer, and to make sure that we get the best
value for money, and particularly with regard to the governance, amongst the things that we insist on being part and parcel of the agreement going forward is a restraint of trade. There are, as the Commissioner has explained, maybe some difficulties with regard to enforcing completely. However, to also put the onus on the suppliers, that we have some remedial recourse. The intention is that we actually try to force good behavior as opposed to having historical recourse afterwards, because we really like, once we have decided to award this contract, to make them be successful and get the best value for money on that. Chairperson, the other matter we've insisted on is that there is vetting and continuous vetting, not only on DCS employees, but also on consultant employees as well. And they need to know up front that that is part of the deal if they want to do business with us. It would still be subject to negotiation, but those are some of the matters that we are insisting on these contracts. And the other matter is also not just apart from processes that we put in place at DCS, is to also inform, for example, the Office of the Audit General and the SIU and our internal audit and other assurance providers as well of these major contracts coming up as a risk, and for them to do their necessary assurance as well, as opposed to they just being reactive later on. And amongst other things, from the processes we put is also to build in a necessary due diligence for the various processes so we can rectify a remedy as we go along, as opposed to reactive afterwards and facing damage control. The restraint of trade we spoke about is also a cooling off period with the prospective service providers as well, to recognize that it may create a competitive environment for employees to go through, however, but to get a sense of comfort that we've always had the benefit of an arm's length transaction and not been unduly prejudiced as a department by involvement of certain officials in these transactions. Chair, on the other matter, I think there was an outstanding question on by one of the members on alternative models to outsourcing. One of the requirements before the outsource is that there is a feasibility study, and invariably it would be for special services that we cannot provide in that space of time. In that, the other models would be co-sourcing and then insourcing. Co-sourcing is we still retain part of the risk, and insourcing is really a body shop where we get the individuals on board. Then the outsourcing would be when you transfer the risk completely, and then people would have to confine the bodies and deliver the service in that period of time. However, it would be at a premium, of course, that the cost would be higher. So that advantages you would have recourse against the service provider. Another sense of comfort is that when there are variations or extensions to a contract, it needs to go through the whole procurement process again and be approved by the village adjudication committee, so that to prevent a supplier coming in at a particular price, and once you have them on the premises, they come with a huge valuation to having to supply the product or the service. So that we also insist to them that it goes to the village adjudication committee again for evaluation of it, and procure the necessary funds. Thank you very much.
Let me take another round. Then I will give you. Let me also ask mine, and then you come in as Cindy and
Chairperson, can I just on the issue of outsourcing of recruitment just make a statement and say that?
Yes.
I think it would be incorrect to deny the concerns, disregard the concerns of the committee around the issues of outsourcing of recruitment processes. And I think Mr. Sechali tried to explain, and I want to emphasize, that we need to, where necessary, partner with some of these contractors. And he explained particularly two instances where that is the case. In the first instance, when it comes to using the headhunting process because of the risk involved, when you do not give the headhunting process over to someone who's more objective, that we will have to continue to use these contractors. But in the second instance, where we have to embark on major recruitment drives, particularly for entry level, but that for the normal day-to-day recruitment, it remains something that we do specifically. Now, having said that you have a concern, I think that I really ask the committee to understand some of the challenges that we face, especially with entry-level recruitment, where you have these large numbers of people, and you need to document exactly, because in terms of our law, you need to give any individual person a response as to why he or she has not been successful. And these type of activities really require the kind of human resources that we don't have. And as Mr. Chintande explained, because these things happen occasionally, it doesn't help us to put a whole huge capacity there, and it's wasted for most of the time. But I think what I would want to ask corporate services in response to the concerns of the committee is to how we overcome some of the issues such as those raised by Ms. Chikunga, where people from rural areas are not benefiting, or largely urban candidates, or people from a particular area where we want to focus the recruitment team to be pushed out. I think we need to find a way of overcoming those things by perhaps giving these people quotas, for example, and say that so many must come from rural areas in order to empower people from those communities as well. So many must be women. Those are things we already tell them. But I think we need to sharpen so that I'm really asking for consideration of the challenges that we face while we are responsive to the concerns that you have raised as well.
Commissioner, you see, I don't know what are these recruiting companies looking for. What is the criteria? I gave you two CVs, applications, where these two people went through a college studying correctional management and whatever. They have applied for the past 10 years. What qualification? I understand the qualification is grade 12. But these people went as far as a college to say that we want to go and work in, but we want to empower ourselves to go and work in correctional services. Yeah, it's skipped off, or the recruiting company saying no. Not even looking at it. What is the criteria for these people to qualify and to go into correctional? What are they looking at? Can you give clarity on both?
Yes, thank you, Chair. The specifications contained in the advert is normally provided by DCS itself, and those are normal, the tech entry level,
yeah,
life experience. In the past, we've also put a restriction by saying it's applicants between the ages of 18 and 35. I'm sure that I hope the committee would concur with me that in itself is discriminatory, and I've recently given an instruction that we should remove that provision. Many people fell outside of that provision because they may have been older than 35, for example, and therefore, when they apply over and over again, they miss that opportunity because by the time they do eventually qualify, they fall foul of the cutoff age. So I've given an instruction that we do away with that. And in fact, that when we recruit for Kimberley, I think the only criteria that I would still insist that there's an element of fitness of the people coming into our system. And fitness you can describe or define in any way, but I think we need to eliminate the other exclusion clauses there. Apart from that, I think clearly when looking at a large number of applicants, one would say you tend to shortlist those people who have further qualifications. So they would make it through the first round possibly. In your case, I don't know if they made it through the first round or at what point they fell out. They've never even been invited for an interview. So I don't have an explanation on why someone with, say, a three-year correctional services diploma would be excluded, unless, of course, it's the fact of age, for example.
Young people, young girls.
So then they may, you see, because when you say the cutoff age being 18, And you look at, it doesn't mean that it necessarily, because it's also the life experience that becomes a consideration. So it could be any reason. One would have, need to have all the facts related to the particular application.
I know Cindy wants to ask, and but let me ask my question. In this annual report, you are saying, Commission, that it is not true that consultant is running the department. But in your annual report, instead, the figure must go down on the payment of consultants, it went up. 2005, 2006, it was 154 million. 2006, 2007, it was 206 million. What is your explanation in that? And that is for consultants, contractors, and special services. Why are we having this increase in that? The other question, Commissioner, catering. In the presentation, I see catering. Can you explain? Because we are from a visit recently in Kostas. This one person is sitting there in an office. The inmates are doing the food. This contractor are taking these figures that you gave to us now here. This contractor is taking this money away. Can you explain why are we not? It's true what happened in the past. But we are having special investigating unit now. We are having the department investigating unit. Why are we not utilizing inmates? They are doing it. Why must we pay a person from a contract or a consultant or whatever to do that? Why? And I think it's this big prison. The contracts went to catering, went to this big prison. Crossley, Paul Small, Johannesburg, and why are we not utilizing the inmates? The inmates are doing it. My question is, why are we paying these people this money? If the inmates are still doing it, they are doing it from here. Even when Omben was in prison, the inmates were cooking, and they are still cooking now. But somebody else is getting the money. Why? Cindy?
No, thank you, Chairperson. Probably covered one of my questions, but I also wanted to just add on what the minister was saying there, with regard to the recruitment, to say that in order to deal with the problem of accommodation and transport, they take people from the surroundings. I remain opposed to that, because it actually means that for Barberton it will always be people from Barberton. There isn't any prison in rural areas. So it actually means there will always be excluded because they are not in the surrounding area of the prison. And I would say this until I've read on my face, but I think it is correct. And as a result, if you go to Barberton, the people around Barberton think that the prison belongs to them, and people who must be employed in Barberton are the people from Barberton. Once you come from Buluz in the same Mpumalanga area, you're not supposed to go in. And I think it is wrong. It excludes people from the rural area, those children that do not have opportunities because of the type of school they attend. They will always be left aside, and I think it is wrong. So I think it should not be emphasized. That's how I feel. And I understand the reasons behind it, but I think it shouldn't be a criteria at all where it is possible. But 2%, I asked the question on the disadvantages and I got a list of them, I think about two. I think that one of the other disadvantages also would be the fact that they are patchy and unsustainable because of the fact that they are making profit. And I believe that the punishment and rehabilitation need to be controlled by the state. For me, the use of private companies in the manner we are doing now, somehow it weakens the capacity of state to control and regulate corrections. I think somehow we cannot claim that we are indeed in control. And I think correctional services in the main has a lot to do with security of the country. And if everything is somehow outsourced, including the recruitment of people, I'm not very sure whether that is not the case. And how is the department dealing with these disadvantages? Some mentioned by the gentleman that he was answering the question, but what I think is also the disadvantages. Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, I'll send you corrections on what maybe I'm going to say. Chairperson, I'm worried about this privatization in terms of this recruitment on the salary of our members. Chairperson, I think since 2005, I came to this committee. We're born oversight, the whole province. There's a lot of pride in terms of our members. And you yourself, Chairperson, you were saying to them, you understand that their work, they're more than the work of the police. Because the police is staying with the inmate for three hours or 2 minutes to write that statement. And our members are staying with the inmate that has been sentenced 25 years or less, day and every day. And the cry that they have is the salary that they are getting. And I'm worried, Chairperson, if we've got this privatization, we've got this outsourcing of this recruiting, whereby they recruit from our members. Red Chairperson, even myself, I can go for better because I want to live a better life. Our members are getting less than less, but we've got outsourced for the private that they can get more than our members. I think we need to look at this, Chairperson. We are in government. But the government cannot pay their staff, but the private can pay more, Chairperson. I don't know. Maybe if today we cannot debate it, but we need this debate, Chairperson. We cannot go oversight always and get this cry from our members, and we don't get any answer. And I believe that it is right a report on the cry of the members in terms of their salary. Then if this private is continuing and continuing, that means we are end up always saying we've got a vacance of employment, a vacance now and then. And we know very well that these people, they leave our center and go to the private because they're getting more. I don't know about this privatization, Chairperson, that when are we going to continue about it, until when? That's why I'm worried about this 25 years, Chairperson. I'm very, very worried about this 25 years. I don't know what are we doing. We need to visit this and correct it, Chairperson. I thank you.
Thanks, Madam Gwenda. Baba Fisha?
Chair, firstly, I just wanted to respond to the question I asked, because I want to help from my experience. You know, in prison, the greatest problem and the cancer, the question of smuggling, is the greatest cancer.
silently, you know, we had to deal with it for many, many years. To the extent that we decided that now we have to select people from our own organization, senior people who can be there in the kitchen. That's the kitchen. Because when you are in the kitchen, you are able to do anything in winning over anybody, because they've got the resources. The resources are in the kitchen. Food, it means you can buy Dhaka, you can buy anything, you can buy anybody, because they're working in the kitchen. So it means you need people there who are conscious and committed. Now, my suggestion, therefore, would be how we manage at the end of the day to win over the kitchen is to take people who have been rehabilitated and who are about to go out to prison, so that they must be those, the monitors, you call, there was a term used called monitors, the people who are classified as eight group or whatever, and to put them in the kitchen. At least you can take a risk away, rather than taking anybody who has a long term, but take somebody who feels that who has the hope of going out of prison. Then you can put him there, and he has been rehabilitated, and we have seen his record, track record. Then you put him in the kitchen. Because very much enticing kitchen in the question of smuggling. Smuggling, it's where it works. It works in the kitchen. That's not the problem.
Thank you very much. Mr. Shah, I'm giving you 2 minutes because
I'm trying to... Okay, can I get you very quickly? Chair, I would like to know the nature of relationship with the DCS and these private prisons. What's the nature of relationship and the level of jurisdiction that DCS enjoys over these private institutions? And secondly, in terms of evaluation, has the DCS done an evaluation, or does it intend to do an evaluation of, in terms of comparing the performance in terms of quality and efficiency in terms of administration of these private prisons versus or compared to those prisons which are under DCS control? Have we done that kind of a survey and evaluation? Is there a synergy between the both systems? Because perhaps we could learn something. If they're doing something better, maybe we can learn and incorporate that within those prisons which are under their care. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Because we must deal with the other report only for Commissioner?
Thank you, Chair, honourable members. Yes, I think you've pointed us to the annual reports for the past 3 years and the upward trend. And I have my copy of the annual report here. I need to make sure I respond to it in order of years.
Yeah, it's page 112. Page 112.
The 2004-2005 under consultants is reflected here, total amount of 3.7 million rand. The subsequent year, it is reflected an amount of 4.4 million plus the 2000. The two projects, in fact, is still the same project that's covered in the same years, which relates to the development of junior and middle management leadership program, because it covered, it was done over a 2-year process, and the subsequent one is the issues of compliance audit on occupational health and safety. In the last year, in fact, the year that under discussion, if I just look at the cost of consultants, we're talking about the language preference and English proficiency at a cost of $394,383, and the HR policy and procedure refinement at a cost of $171,000. So, Chairperson, I'm looking at those columns that in fact shows that under that item, report on consultant appointments using appropriated funds, the year under discussion is down. So I'm really struggling to find the reference that you are trying to point me to.
I am saying 112. Yes.
In 2006-07, yes. Financial year, what page?
112.
Page 112. Page 112 of the 2006-07 annual report, consultants, contractors in special services, 2005-6, 154385 and 206-685 in 2006-07. Okay, now that's why I'm saying I was confused, because I was looking at the consultants. I think it's been you throw together consultants, contractors, and special services. But obviously, we'll be talking about that increase. It's going to be quite difficult for me to respond to it, other than to say that the needs obviously change, and the nature of what is outsourced would also change, because we include their contractors and special services as well as consultants. I would have to unpack what those specific contracts are. So I'm afraid I can't respond to it in a direct sense, other than to say that, yes, indeed, we constantly have to evaluate what people can do better than ourselves, because if you do a fair assessment of that, then you will also have to see what we paid for elsewhere for that same service that must be outsourced. But if you want to engage with that, we can do the sums and then come back and talk. Why are we not utilizing inmates? I think at a big correctional facility, but I think if I can just be directed, you're referring specifically here to the outsourcing of the nutrition contract and how inmates continue to do the cooking and other things while these contracts have been outsourced. The first response to that is part of the contract provides for the actual development of inmates. It's part of our development and rehabilitation work, so it's an essential part, and we monitor, in fact, the extent to which the contractor provides that service, because that will remain, and the cost factors are built into the contract itself. I'm being distracted here. Yes, indeed, it's part of our development, and one the cost is factored on the basis that you would use offender labor where that is required and justified, and in terms of development purposes. The issues raised by Ms. Chukunga on recruitment, I think the point is well taken, Ms. Chukunga, the fact that we may be talking here about a perversion if we insist that people are recruited from the area where the correctional facility is located, and that one need to have a balance. I agree with you, we need to have a balance, and we also need to take into account other factors, because very often people coming from outside really struggle to find suitable accommodation, and it places tremendous pressure on the department to provide official accommodation. But I think it's the appropriate balance that we need to find in order to make sure that we do not exclude people coming from rural areas in particular, and in terms of my earlier suggestion that we may want to just look at quotas to ensure that particular balance. So I think we're on the same page there. You've spoken about some of the disadvantages, and I think you related directly to the disadvantages of the outsourcing of correctional centers according to the PPP model. Indeed, you're right. There is a disadvantage that you may weaken the ability of the state to execute its security function in the sense that inmates are being held under contractors who are not employees of the state. I think part of my response would have to be built into the question also asked by Mr. Shah in terms of how we regulate that relationship, because that's fundamental. The relationship is regulated in the first instance by a very tight service level agreement and the establishment of structures, including people from the state and people from outside who monitor the contractual obligations of the contractor. And there are severe penalties built in. For example, if there should be an escape, there's a penalty that the contractor would have to pay in order to minimize the risk and to build in a disincentive. If, I think those amounts are quite huge when you have an escaped inmate or if someone dies of unnatural causes or those type of incidences. But to come back to the issue of the security, I think the point really is a valid one. I think other countries have also grappled with the same matter, and different countries respond to it differently. The main issue here really is the scope. In other words, what's the critical mass or the critical threshold? Obviously, if you outsource the bulk of your security or your facilities, the risk increases, and so for us, we need to assess the tolerance and the risk tolerance for the outsourcing, and I think that was taken into consideration in the initial decision when the policy decision was taken in this regard. But it's indeed a question going forward that we must engage with, Mr. Kunga. In fact, I've already said to the chair of the portfolio committee, going forward, there is a maximum threshold that I would think we should not exceed in terms of the outsourcing of PPPs and in terms of future policy, even if it means that we need to revisit the Public Finance Management Act that stipulates that we should have a transaction advisory board. And when all these things are being put on the table, and the answer quite clearly is if you're looking for issues of risk transfer, value for money, that you're going to have the PPP route beginning to be more attractive in terms of the cost savings that I've indicated. But whether it's desirable is a different question, and that is the question that we must answer and when we debate this matter from a policy perspective. So it is indeed a very relevant one that I don't want to engage with in too much detail now, but I think Parliament and should, in discussion on the PFMA and subjecting security type of processes to the feasibility route, that's part of where that debate must be located. Ms. Nguyenia, you've also raised, again, some of the concerns, obviously, of the, you came back to raise the concern of 25 years period, and I've said to, it's very difficult to debate this issue around the 25 years. Ideally, I'm saying we would want to shorten that period. In fact, we said that in terms of the department's preference, we would in fact go for a public finance model for a shorter period, put up front a higher amount of money based on affordability. But when you begin to do that, you throw away the whole notion of partnering with a private partner because it doesn't become economically viable for industry to compete. So the issue of years is really linked to the issue of affordability and whether it becomes still an option that where we can partner with the state. There are also other issues that because we're in the procurement process at the moment, I can't debate the issue further, but I think we are looking at the issue of years and as far as possible make that part of our process of procurement. If I say too much about it now, again, you will have a situation of people who are competing, trying to structure their proposals around those possibilities. So I'm afraid I'll have to stay quiet on that, given the fact that we're in the process of the request for quality qualifications assessment. On the issue of staff not being, on government not being able to pay staff, again, I want to pick up on my earlier point of the per capita cost versus the salaries. I think that answers part of that question. But I do know that when you conduct oversight visits, it is really a repetitive refrain on the part of staff that they need to be paid better. I can assure you that we have made some strides, and you may be aware of the fact that we have agreed last year after the public sector strike, in terms of Resolution 1 of 2007, to introduce what is called an occupation-specific dispensation for correctional officials, and work is currently being undertaken to complete that the proposal, and the idea is to implement the occupation-specific dispensation specifically for correctional officials with effect from the 1st of July 2008. Now, I need to say up front here again that the occupation specific dispensation will bring considerable increase on the part of certain categories of staff, depending on the level of remuneration. But I need to emphasize it is primarily a career pathing model, in other words, to ensure that people go up in the ranks and continue to better themselves in terms of the job content and how they are being remunerated. So we've already completed the OSD, the occupation-specific dispensation for nurses, and in the previous year for social workers. And as I've said at the beginning, these are also quite helpful in terms of arresting the outflow of people from the public service. Ben, I think you've just made a statement there related to the risk of smuggling at the kitchens, and I can really concur with you. That is why part of the specifications for the nutrition contract is indeed our ability to monitor, you know, through closed-circuit television, what happens at in the kitchen. So the successful tender should have that as part of the proposal, because that is indeed our major risk. But yes, I can confirm that we largely do use monitors, you know, in our kitchens, and it's not the maximum high-risk inmates. I think I've responded to the point that you've raised, Mr. Shaw, about the relationship. Perhaps we've not spoken about the evaluation, and just briefly there to say that yes, indeed, we do undertake evaluation of the PPP. We do send out our risk management team to assess the extent to which, or rather our inspection team, to look at the extent to which they are complying to the policies and the contract that we have put in place. We have recently undertaken, we've asked the transaction advisors to revisit both these two contracts, because we were saying that we want to see if there's a possibility of renegotiating some of the terms of these two older PPPs, considering the fact that we were not as clever when we negotiated it initially, so that we could bring down the per capita cost, make it cheaper for the state. There were presentations to this committee on the results of those evaluations, and basically the proposals at that stage was that we should consider additional work of an infrastructure nature at the minimum cost that could lead to, for example, double bunking and therefore increase the number of people at these facilities and then reducing the actual cost at the minimum expenditure. So we have been through that process, and we've opted not to go that route at this stage. I'm not saying at that stage. I'm not saying we should remain close to it. We should constantly look at ways of saving more money and being more efficient, and extending the little that we do have. But it is a feature of our involvement, the ongoing evaluation and extent to assessing the whether they comply to the contract conditions. Thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. I think that we have interrogated this session and this briefing thoroughly. I know that we can never finish this topic. But I think that at least we have done justice today to go into depth into this thing. Commissioner, obviously, I know that we are having two other documents, but we are sitting with 15 minutes.
15-minute meeting, we will give to your department, so that you can. The issue of precautionary suspension,
yeah,
and then the litigation, the case. But you see, Commissioner, it's not necessary if your department, if they want to say something, it's fine. Commissioner, it's a worrying factor. The committee have expressed their unhappiness and concern about this issue of outsourcing and the use of consultants. And I want to make it very clear that we are public representatives who must approve a budget of the department. And we can only approve the budget of correctional services when we, as this portfolio committee, are also satisfied that the funds allocated to the department is well spent. But some of the issues that the members have raised today here, including myself, are very much worrisome. And I hope, Commissioner, that the department will go back and think about this concern that the members have raised today. In reviewing some of the issues that we have said today, for instance, the issue of catering, please go back and review that issue of outsourcing kitchens. Go and review the issue of recruitment of staff into the department. I think that, Commissioner, there is no such a thing that each and every decision that we are taking is cast in stone. We review and review each and every time what is the best for the country. And I really hope, Commissioner, that we must do that. And I'm very much positive that you have shown your positive approach, your opening remarks, that you have given the special investigating unit other areas to investigate. It shows that you are serious in addressing this problem, and that is positive toward the committee, because you are open and you want to make a success of this department. I can promise you, from our side, as the portfolio committee, we'll give you all the support necessary to help you in cleaning up the department, because it's very much in the interest of all of us. It's in the interest of the whole of the country. Correctional services is part and parcel of the security institutions in the country. And we must do our best to make it a better department. Commissioner, I don't know if the department wants to brief us on this or what.
Chairperson, no, I think I should not be so cruel to the committee. Because you will recall that we went through both the presentations, the one on the suspensions, and the committee requested us to give a further breakdown in order to look at suspension in excess of 24 months. In what we've given you, we've actually broken it down in categories so that we showed our concern with suspensions in excess of 3 months. I am aware that that presentation itself may lack specific detail of such names and incidences and therefore reasons, But given the numbers that we're working with, it will make it impossible in one presentation to document it. And so we've tried to really give it in such a way. But if there are specific concerns emanating from the information that we've given you, we're quite willing to answer those specific questions in writing as a follow-up. But I don't think we need to delve into the detail of that presentation. The second outstanding matter is really we have gone through the presentation on liabilities, legal liabilities, and you will recall that some of the slides presented were not part of the facts of committee members, and so we have issued you with the full facts related and that provide the kind of details. But I think we've dealt with the content issues around these two presentations. And again, I would want to say that if there are outstanding matters, I would be quite happy to respond to those in writing with the concurrence of the committee, Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Commissioner. I don't think that any member wants to ask a question on that issue. Nobody. Thanks, Commissioner. Members, before we lunch organized outside for us. But on Friday we had a meeting, and there's two reports that was on the table, but due to technical problems. Mr. Tipido and Mr. Self and Bishop Dolo have proposed that we adopt this report, its minutes, and our follow-up report on POSMO. And we went through it, but due to technical things, we could not went further. I don't know what is the committee saying.
Chair, if our colleagues made recommendations in that meeting, if they are satisfied that we went through a draft and that the necessary corrections were affected to the report, then I don't see why there should be any reason why we shouldn't adopt it. If you as the chairperson are satisfied that they are reflecting the sentiments of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shah. So you are proposing and then seconded by Mr. Tipido. So the two reports, the minutes and the report is adopted by the committee. Thank you very much, members. With this word, Commissioner, thanks once again for the briefing. You know that we are partnered with one defender, and this is only to strengthen the Department of Corruption to ask this probing question. It's not our intention to fight with the department. No, it's our department. You know, the Minister of Finance has said the other day, we are in it together. And that is what we must do, all of us. And I hope that the staff must also understand that when they come here, it's not because we are enemies. No, we want really to assist the department. Thank you very much,
Andrea.
Thank you.
Just to the members of the committee in itself, express our gratitude. We really do not experience this as hostility when we have to come to account to you. In fact, I think it's the last point that you've raised, that you hope that we will go back and think seriously about some of these issues that you've raised. I can assure you that we will indeed do so. Particularly around the issues of recruitment, outsourcing of recruitment, and secondly, the nutrition contract. I think I need to put on record here that as far as the nutrition contract is concerned, it's about to expire, but because of the fact that we've not allowed for sufficient time to do the proper evaluation and feasibility, we would have to renew that contract, albeit with certain improvement in the short term. But beyond that, to really reassess the appropriateness of outsourcing nutrition within our correctional facilities through a more comprehensive study and the implications of that outsourcing on our development program and our funds as well. So I give you that undertaking. Of course, we've also noticed your concerns around the outsourcing of the correctional centers And I've said that I'm quite open to debate those issues with members of the committee further at the previous session until the committee is really satisfied that all the issues have been explained. So thank you for doing what you are doing and for asking those very difficult questions with a lot of, what should I say, mercy. We certainly don't feel it as hostile. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.